digitally uploaded.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Digitally Uploaded podcast. I am Matthew Sainsbury, the editor-in-chief of Digitally Downloaded. And with me this week, we've got Alan.
Hey, guys.
And Chris.
Heyo.
Let's get straight into it. Welcome back, and that is a track from Knights of Azure, a Koei Tecmo game that is being released next week and is sounding really good. I can't actually talk about it just yet because of embargoes and so on, but look forward to my review. It's going to be a big one. So, the news this week is that there wasn't a whole lot of news. There was a couple of rumors, but we don't do rumors. So let's talk about the concrete bits of stuff that we do know about. I guess the most exciting bit of news for me this week was that Atelier Sophie has been confirmed for a Western release. Not that I guess anybody kind of thought that it wouldn't be, but hey, anything to get excited about an Atelier game. And yeah, it's going to be the first PlayStation 4 Atelier title, which means it'll have an upgrade to visuals and so on, and when they look as good as they do, when the art direction is as good as it is, that in itself is reason to be excited. It'll be interesting to see how Gust's engines go on the PlayStation 4. And yeah, very, very, very excited about it. I know Chris is probably looking forward to that one as well.
Yeah, very much so. I was a fan of the Atelier games back in the very beginning. So, like, I have the first three Iris games on the PS2. But I found the time mechanic a bit of a turn off on the PS3 generation of games. So I actually haven't played an Atelier game since Iris 3 on the PS2. I understand that the time mechanic was done away with in Shally, which was the most recent title, but I didn't feel comfortable hopping on with that one because it was the third in an episodic series of three. So with Sophie being a brand new entry and without the time mechanic, I'm really looking forward to getting back into that series again.
Yeah, it's funny. My first Atelier game was actually Rorona on the PlayStation 3, so I kind of got into it when the time mechanic kind of kicked off, and I liked it. I know that it's controversial. It's been a controversial feature with fans of the series and fans of JRPGs in general. I always felt it kind of worked, but I can see where they're coming from at the same time. So when Shally came around and it didn't have the time mechanic, I guess I got a sense of what the Atelier games were originally. And yeah, they're I can see why you didn't want to jump into it with the third game, because it does have a certain level of, I guess, back knowledge. When you get a chance to, I do recommend checking out the first two, because even though there is that time mechanic, it is really, really de-emphasized, and I don't think you'll have any issues with it. And the Dusk series is probably my favorite trilogy of JRPGs ever, so I really recommend you give it a go when you get a chance, Chris. And then, of course, play the next one once it lands on the PlayStation 4.
Yeah, I definitely will check out Sophie, no question about that.
Okay, so another bit of news, which is probably more relevant for me than anybody else, but the Hatsune Miku Future Tone games have had some details released for them on the PlayStation 4. We still don't have a Western release for those games. Sega would be pretty crazy not to. But in terms of the actual music, you're looking at between going to be they're actually it's actually so big that they're splitting the release into two bits. On one half, you have about 120 songs, and on the other, 100. So if you buy into the whole thing, you're looking at 220 songs of Hatsune Miku goodness, which is going to be enough that I will probably disappear off the face of the planet for a couple of months once it releases.
Can we also just quickly give a quick shout out to the whole Digital Homicide Jim Sterling suing saga, which is hilarious and confusing and baffling to everyone?
I'm not sure I know anything about that.
Oh, so Digital Homicide is a terrible, terrible game dev that is trying to sue Jim Sterling for saying that their games are terrible because they are terrible. Basically, they're suing him for $10 million in what is the most bizarre lawsuit I've ever seen in my life. I read through some of their details, and one of the complaints is that they compare Jim Sterling compared them to the Wet Bandits from Home Alone. That's in a legal document. And it's just, I don't understand.
Yeah, it's pretty funny to watch, I guess. Saying that, we'll probably be sued now as well, because you called them a bad game dev, Alan.
Yeah.
But I guess the thing is, I've been following it for quite a while. Jim Sterling has a vendetta against Digital Homicide that he probably doesn't need to have. In fairness, I mean,
it's one thing
to say games are bad, but if you watch the Jim Sterling go on and on and on about it, it's a little bit ridiculous. He's just playing it because it gets in traffic and all of that kind of stuff. So I sympathise with Digital Homicide that they're probably copying more than other bad devs are from him.
In all
fairness, there are a lot of very bad game devs out there, and Digital Homicide's not the only one, but Jim Sterling does tend to single them out a lot. But at the same time, you can't sue a media personality, journalist, whatever, for the reasons that they want to sue him. I mean, it's criticism.
It's basically protected by
like every media kind of law out there. So that lawsuit's not going to work. And it'll kind of die away, which I guess Jim will then milk for all it's worth.
Yeah, I mean, it's also setting a really good precedent for all this YouTube DMCA nonsense that tends to happen a lot with some people. So that'll be good to have that actually sorted out in the future. That's pretty much all I really have to say about that. It's going to be bizarre to watch, and even bizarrer to see them try and actually pull it off.
Yeah. Okay, that was it, I guess, for a week of pretty quiet news. Rumors aside, we'll jump to a music track and then come back and talk about some more interesting things. Welcome back, everyone. That was a track from Shantae. We all love Shantae music, so we're going to use it in our podcast as much as possible. Let's jump into the meat of the discussion this week. We thought that it would be interesting. It's a topic that's kind of dear to all our hearts again. We all like games that have a good quality narrative in them, and we thought we'd, I guess, discuss examples of good narrative, what we look for in narrative from games as we play them, and I guess various other things, like topics such as if a game is focused almost entirely on narrative, do we still call it a game? Let's start off with Chris, I think. Chris, when you're playing a video game, what are you looking for in the narrative?
Well, I'm kind of an outlier from a lot of RPG fans when it comes to narrative, because narrative isn't essential for me. A lot of my gaming tastes originally, before I even got into RPGs, come from the whole arcade challenge-based design school. So I often focus more on mechanics and play when I evaluate a game, and narrative kind of comes second in my consideration. I always consider it kind of like pie and ice cream, right? Like, pie and ice cream is amazing, but if you have a piece of pie without the ice cream, it's still a really delicious piece of pie. And that's kind of how I look at games without a fantastic narrative. That being said, when a game has a really good narrative, like the ice cream on the pie, it makes a great thing even better. So when I'm looking for a really great game narrative, what really has to happen for me is that the narrative has to enhance a game in a way that's distinctly gamey. And by that I mean any book or movie can also have a story. So for a game's narrative to be especially interesting to me, it has to tie into that game.
Sure. So I guess when you talk about, does that mean if you're playing a JRPG and it has a terrible narrative, in theory, that you're not particularly fussed?
Yeah, right. Like say Final Fantasy V. I think Final Fantasy V has like an incoherent, boring plot, but I enjoy the combat and the job system so much that the gameplay of the game still makes me a fan of the game. I'm not turned off entirely from game if the narrative itself isn't super interesting to me. Now, a great narrative in a game for me is something like what you see in games like Nier or Goichi Suda's No More Heroes. What I like is when a narrative becomes meta-textual and it actually ties into the gameplay. That to me is a really great narrative in a game, because that can only happen in a game. Like when the narrative is actually modified by the gameplay. So like, in Nier, you become overpowered through repetitive playthroughs, and then the fear enemies have of how overpowered you are becomes part of the narrative as well. So in that instance, your interactivity with the game feeds the narrative, and it kind of creates this unique loop, and that's only possible in a game. That's not possible in film or a novel, so that's when I really love a game narrative.
Well, I'm just going on that topic, actually. So I think the most important things that games have the ability to do is to have player interaction as a narrative driver.
Bingo.
And to that extent, every game should take advantage of that. Like, every game, because there's nothing else. Like, you can always write a story like it's a book for a game, but it won't be a game. It'll be a book story in a game. And that's not exciting. What the main thing that I think is really, really important is creating a narrative world rather than just creating a narrative linear story, which is why I'd like to talk about Binding of Isaac probably in a little bit, just through its, world building and then creating this, like, story about Isaac himself rather than having it being force-fed to you and, having to piecemeal itself through the player's own interactions with the world. So, you pick up an item, what does Isaac do with it? Why does he do that? And then going further on, and then looking at the bosses and what that means to him and what it means about the greater narrative. Games have the ability to do a lot of things that no other media really can, and I want to see that taken more advantage of, honestly.
I guess I come from it from a slightly different perspective to you guys, in that I'm kind of a narrative guy through and through, and I would say that narrative is a key a key point that I look for in games, to the point where if a game doesn't have a good quality narrative or doesn't do anything with the narrative, I kind of get turned off it, regardless of how good the gameplay is. And in terms of how narratives are written, I'm not overly fussed with games having a narrative written from the point of view that this needs to be a game. So, for an example, you know, if completely linear story-based games don't worry me, I'm not concerned about having choice about my narrative in games. One of the things I generally find frustrating in Telltale games, for example, is the way that they try to hoist choice onto the player, and it inevitably becomes limited in how it plays out because they have a story to tell, so they try and conceal that. They try and provide choice, but at the same time they try and tell their own story. One of the challenges I think the game developers face is if they are looking to tell a story, that kind of means that they can't put player choice in there, because they can't control how the player would then play out their scenarios. So short of actually writing a full in-depth narrative for every single possible player choice, their player choices are going to be either quite limited or non-existent if the developer has a story they particularly want to tell themselves.
Well, I mean, just continuing on that, actually, it doesn't actually mean, well, at least in my opinion, it doesn't mean that choice is, like, the main thing about creating a game narrative. For me, it's actually all about reflecting those choices in the world. And things like, you know, in Deus Ex, Human Revolution, in the first mission when you save or kill the hostages by accident or whatever, or, you know, you shoot some people, you get different responses from the NPCs based on that. So when you're walking out and if you take the lethal option, one of the soldiers says, you know, oh, we're going to need a lot more body bags here. And he's just on his, like, little headpiece thing talking to someone about this, and it's just reflecting the world through your own choices in a very, very small way, but it makes the world seem like it's more alive, and that's the only thing a game can do, because if that was in a movie, you'd be like, yep, that's been scripted, he was going to do that all the time. But if you do it in like a non-lethal way in Deus Ex, you get a completely different thing. It's just him saying, wow, you're a super cool guy, Adam Jensen, I wish I had your amazing eye sunglasses things. And then, yeah, that's the only thing that games have above any other medium, and I think it needs to be exploited more, it needs to be used more, and I want it.
The thing about choice, and especially in video games, is that it's an illusion. Any serious game developer with any kind of clever ideas about design will tell you that really good game design isn't about giving the player choice, but about creating the illusion of choice in a way that's seamless, corralling the player while giving them kind of the feeling that they have control over the situation, but they actually don't. That's why I'm kind of often offended or not really interested by games like things like Mass Effect or Telltale games, where the idea of choice is just selecting language options from a dialogue, and it becomes like, oh, you've made the good choice or the bad choice, because choice in game design to be effective has to merely be an illusion, and the best place to do that is through actual gameplay, not through making selections in a menu. You have to make the player feel empowered, and you can't do that just by making them select three text choices.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I guess when I'm looking for the examples of player choice that I think are effective, it's where they're kind of organic to the game world, to your point, Chris. So to use a really good example that I keep coming back to, despite it being a very old game, Dungeons & Dragons Wake of the Ravager was released in like the 90s or something. You can still grab it on good old games if you want. But it has a really good example of the kind of choice I like to see in games. There's this scene where you're part of an kind of a secret society resistance force against a tyrannical kind of overlord. And then that overlord discovers where the secret base of this organization is and sends its forces in there to, I guess, wipe it all out. You discover you kind of come back to the base after doing the mission in the middle of that attack happening, and then you've got a couple of choices that you don't have. It's not presented through a menu option. It's just kind of the way you react to that affects how things play out. You can kind of turn around and run out because there's an awful lot of enemies in there, and it's a pretty much a slaughter. If you do, and then come back to the base afterwards, basically everyone's dead. There's a couple of zombies and whatever left around that attack you, and then you have to piece together what happened based on the destruction and so on. Alternatively, you can stand and fight and save some of the people, and then they'll help you progress the plot further. What I liked about it, I mean, it's basically a simple kind of binary choice, you know, fight or run. But it was never presented through a menu. It's entirely your own decision.
Exactly. That's the perfect sort of game narrative, in my opinion. It's the illusion of choice without menu saying, do you want to choose the good option or the bad option? Which, again, I'd like to talk about Witcher 3, because that game is written so well, and I adore a specific part of that game. Like, I've only just really started playing it, but there's one part where you find this guy, this dwarf guy, whose house has just been burnt down because he's been seen as supporting the new armed forces in the area, which I'm not going to spoil anything because it's a great game and you should all play it because it's rad. Basically, he's like, oh, can you find this arsonist for me? So, you know, you go around, you do some Witcher-based stuff, you know, you look for the clues, you go find this person, and he's obviously very angry and, you know, you can tell he's drunk. And you find him and you know, talk to him, and he's like, oh, no, F that dwarf, he's supporting the new armed forces, he's the worst, kill him. And then you get the choice to either take his bribe and leave with more money or go back and take him to the dwarf. And I did what I thought was the right thing and took him back to the dwarf so he could, like, you know, chide him or whatever, not expecting anything that bad to happen. Yeah, it turns out if you do that, he gets hung. Like, they just take him away and hang him, and it's really, really, really cool, like, that sort of thing. And because, you know, I thought that I was doing the right thing, and then, you know, it's just the worst thing ever. And you talk to this dwarf afterwards and you're like, yeah, the village is really, really gonna hate you now. And he's like, it's so bizarre. And, like, that sort of writing is so, so important to games, because it's, you know, it's, again, it's choice based things that, you know, you think you're doing one thing but you're actually doing another thing, and it's really, really cool, and I want to see that more as well.
Yeah, I do like when games have consequence to your decisions or to what you do in the game that isn't immediately apparent to, you know, it's not projected.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I kind of love Mass Effect with a passion. It's one of the few shooter games that I will, I'd be happy to play over and over again. But one of the things that did, I guess, frustrate me about that game series is the way that the choices, the consequences.
The blue versus red.
Yeah, the consequences to what you're doing is going to be pretty obvious, you know, well before you make the decision. I do prefer, like we've been discussing, a more organic approach where you're not entirely sure what's going to happen until after you make the decision. And that's pretty hard to do, I think. But when it's done well, it's something pretty special.
Definitely, definitely.
All right, we might cut to some music and then come back and talk about some kind of specific examples of some of our favourite narratives in games. Welcome back, everyone. That was a track from Mega Dimension Neptunia VII, which we will, I guess, talk to in a little bit because I do want to talk about the narrative of that series. But we're going to talk about a couple of examples of narratives that we particularly like at the moment or in the past. And we thought we'd get Alan to talk first since he wants to talk about Bloodborne, and Bloodborne's pretty cool.
It is pretty cool, you're right. So Bloodborne is it's a near-perfect game, in my opinion, because it's just so good. Everything about it, from the gameplay design, the enemy designs, the world designs, it's just all wonderful and very, very interesting. But it does something that all the other Miyazaki games do really well as well, and that's world-building through a sort of subliminal narrative. I think everyone here can attest to the fact that all the Miyazaki games are pretty on point when it comes to that sort of thing. Essentially, Bloodborne doesn't really have a narrative, so to speak. I mean, you're not really given much impetus to do things other than you wake up and you're like, oh god, where the hell am I? And then you go to this like weird nightmare thing, and then it's weird, and then you wake up again, and you keep dying, but you keep waking up again in the real world, and it's very bizarre and strange. And that's pretty much all you're really given off the plate. But then as soon as you actually start delving into the game's world, you begin to notice these little things which tell a story. So you'll hear these names like Ludwig or German or, all these like sort of character names. I mean, even Eileen the Crow, you'll know their names by some point, but they're never really explain to you why they're important. You have to go out there and search for it yourself, I mean, and that's one of the more interesting ways to convey a game narrative, I feel, because it requires investment from the player.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think if we're talking about narratives that don't treat their players like idiots, Miyazaki's certainly right up there. And when I was doing creative writing back at university, one of the things we were always told is, a good narrative shows, it doesn't tell. And in the games industry, way too many narratives or stories tell rather than show. I mean, they basically lay everything on the plate and you don't need to think as you're playing. But when you play a Miyazaki game, if you want to get anything out of it, then you kind of have to sit there and you need to explore the world, you need to discover the little bits of lore that are just kind of sitting, hiding out of plain sight. And it's very organic, the way that the worlds are built. Everything has a story behind it, but you don't necessarily know what it is until you've done the exploring and all of that and pieced together the bits. One of my favorite bits about Dark Souls 2, which is obviously which is obviously another Miyazaki game, is that item that you had the chance to take when you're creating your character at the start of the game. You had a whole list of different items that you could start the game with. One of them literally had no purpose, but it was the description of the item was worded in such a way that people were intrigued by it and would select that item just to see if there was some kind of purpose to it. That kind of storytelling is pretty rare in the games industry, and I wish more developers would pay attention to how Miyazaki constructs his stories, because even when they try to make clones of the Souls series, such as Lords of the Fallen, they end up being too explicit with the way they do the narrative, and it kind of ruins the special vibe that his games have.
I just think it's really fascinating, talking about the way Miyazaki tells stories in these games, the actual story behind how he arrived at his method of narrative. And anyone correct me if I get some of the details wrong on this, because it was a couple months ago where this came out in an interview. But from what I understand, he was quite a fan of reading fantasy literature when he was younger, but his reading comprehension was quite poor. So he would attempt to read these books, and to him, it was kind of a foggier experience where he would kind of understand some words but not other words. And to him, it was almost like reaching out to build this narrative in a fog based on the portions of the story that he comprehended. And he would kind of search for these meanings and build these stories himself based on the things he found in the books he was attempting to read. And it's just amazing to me how he took that experience from his past and translated that into a narrative method in his games. It's just an amazing, amazing feat. to take a moment of weakness and turn it into this amazingly strong design philosophy.
I hadn't heard that story. That's really interesting.
It's really cool.
And you can really feel it in the games, exactly how that might feel, to be reading through a book where you only understood maybe every other sentence, to reach out through the fog and pluck these bits out and piece that story together. That's exactly what you do in Dark Souls. An item description here, a quote from a character there, and it's up to you to piece this narrative together. It's amazing.
It kind of speaks to the entire atmosphere of those games too, because I can imagine how, you know, if you're interested in these games, you'd be quite, if you're interested in these novels and struggling to kind of piece them together, it would be a pretty frustrating, melancholic experience. And, you know, the tone of all of his games being quite, not outright horror-based, but just...
Well, Bloodborne, I reckon, definitely, like, though.
Bloodborne's a little bit... It takes Victorian horror and plays with it, but at the same time, it's not horror like the other horror games we play. It's more just that kind of sad...
It's unsettling kind of horror.
Well, Bloodborne is Lovecraftian horror, which is not the same thing as regular horror, which is not the same thing as slasher horror, zombie horror. Lovecraftian horror is about melancholy and fear of the unknown and feelings of powerlessness, which is very different from what we consider horror these days.
And eyes on the inside. Plenty and plenty of eyes on the inside.
Well, yeah, that's what I guess I'm saying. It's kind of reflective of, I guess, the mood you must be in if you're trying to read a story and can't really understand what you're reading. You're not going to... I mean, it would be quite... You would feel quite powerless with regards to the story. So the way the actual design of the games reinforces the way he used to struggle with the stories that he was reading, I find that really quite interesting as well.
Yeah, it makes it clear that they're deeply personal games for him.
Yeah, exactly. And it kind of explains why nobody's been able to exactly, I guess, emulate that experience as yet. Lords of the Fallen being, you know, a good example to try and clone Souls and then failing badly. But, you know, even Salt and Sanctuary, which I'm playing at the moment, which is that little indie game, which tries to be like a 2D Souls, it's good, it's very good, actually, but it doesn't exactly capture what Miyazaki was aiming for with his games, so it feels a little bit different in the end. So if we're to move to something a little bit brighter, I guess, or a lot brighter, the story I'd like to, or the stories I would like to talk about are the Hyperdimension Neptunia ones, because as satires, I think they're probably the most on-point games that we have out there in the industry at the moment. For anybody who hasn't played one of those games, basically they personify each of the game companies that were involved in the console wars over the years, so Sony, Nintendo, Sega, Microsoft, as these characters, which are the girls that you see in the screenshots, and I'm sure you're, even if you haven't played these games, you're probably aware of Neptune and Blanc and Noir and so on. So it personifies each of those those consoles and companies as characters, and then they go off and do their silly little quests with an awful lot of kind of internal references to the console wars as they're playing. And yeah, it's very clever, a lot cleverer than a lot of people give them credit for, in the way that it satirizes the essential silliness of the way that people talk about video game consoles as though they're important. Chris?
One of the things, too, that I love about the early Neptunia games, at least, and I haven't played the more recent ones, but I was quite fond of the remake of the first one, Neptunia Rebirth, is that how they tied the narrative to the concept of criticizing piracy, how often the enemies were symbolic of piracy, and how the console wars and the bickering between the goddesses who represented the game companies was petty compared to the damage being done by the game industry by piracy. I just thought that was so clever.
Yeah, absolutely. And, that's a theme that's kind of transferred on through each of the games thereafter. Certainly always the enemy of the Hyperdimension Neptunia games has been something that is an enemy, I guess, of the games industry as a whole. Even if it's not necessarily piracy, it's like toxic attitudes in video game communities has been targeted for satire slash it is the enemy of the girls. And yeah, it kind of doesn't hold any punches, which I always found fascinating because the Hyperdimension Neptunia series kind of appeals to a lot of those same communities that it mocks a lot of the time. And yeah, I find it pretty interesting that a company is willing to do that. I guess that's kind of part of the reason the series is so niche. Okay. Alan doesn't have anything to say about that game. Obviously, he hasn't played them, which he should.
I'm just sitting here in absolute confusion as to what's happening.
You just need to know that pudding is delicious and Vert is waifu, and that's really, you can progress however you wish after that.
No, not Vert. Blunt.
I love that we always choose different waifus. There's never a clash.
Yeah, that's why we get along. That's why we don't have to fight.
Yeah.
I'm actually surprised the Hyperdimension Neptunia series hasn't actually gone after that as much as yet. That kind of the waifu wars. If it has, I must have missed those references, but yeah, that would be easy material.
There's always room in the next one.
Absolutely. Gotta leave some material. So, Chris, have you got a particular game that you wanted to highlight as a good example of narrative?
I sure do, and I'm going to talk about Bravely Default, and I'm going to spoil pretty much everything about Bravely
Including
Default.
Including the terrible second half?
I will kill you, stop.
No.
Because I'm specifically going to talk about how people are ignorant for thinking that ending is bad. So
frustrating. It's not bad from a narrative thing, it's just frustrating from a gameplay, everything.
There, Alan, there. So once again, I'm going to spoil pretty much everything about Bravely Default. So if you haven't played it yet and having it not spoiled for you is important, you might want to tune out for a couple minutes. So basically, I love Bravely Default because it's kind of a crowning example of the philosophy of design I talked about in the previous segment, wherein it does things with narrative based on introducing gameplay elements in a way that only games can do. The narrative of Bravely Default is only possible within a game because interactivity and the way you engage with the story through your actions is only something that can happen in a game, and those interactions are essential to the telling of the story. As Alan mentioned, the ending portion of Bravely Default is an extremely controversial thing, and it was ripped apart by critics and fans. Because what happens at the end of Bravely Default is once you've awoken all the crystals and saved the world, you discover that it really didn't do anything except for open up an interdimensional rift that you and your friends decide to get in, and then you're taken to a whole nother world where the crystals still need to be saved again. And so the final portion of the game consists of doing this to get the best ending a total of 4 times. So you have to travel to different worlds 4 times and save the crystals. Now, where this first starts being a really brilliant design philosophy is how it ties into the story in terms of terminology and naming. So eventually you discover that by reviving all of the crystals, you've been actually feeding and helping with the destruction of each previous world, helping this kind of spatial evil entity by the name of Ouroboros. So Ouroboros, for those of you who don't research ancient alchemy stuff like I do, because I'm crazy, is actually the name of a classic symbol that ancient alchemists used, which was a serpent devouring its own tail. The serpent devouring its own tail being a symbol of the kind of endless cycle of life and rebirth. So here we have the big bad of the game named after a symbol representing the cycle of life and birth, and here you, the player, are trapped in a continuous cycle wherein you're repeating yourself ad nauseum. So the things you're doing as the player are making direct references that are tied to the literary references used in the game. It's pretty cool. Now, the other thing, once again, you discover that reviving these crystals is actually not the right thing to do. You know, you labor in this game for 60 hours reviving the crystals, thinking you're helping everybody in the world around you, but you find that this is what's feeding this evil entity. One of the things that I'm sure everyone will remember from playing Bravely Default is as you journey to the crystal temples and revive the crystals, there's kind of this laborious mini game you have to play where you mash A for like, it seems like 5 minutes. It takes forever. Your thumb starts to hurt because you're praying to the crystal and you got to keep mashing A, and everyone's like, keep going, keep going. What you don't realize, and this is something you find out only, you know, kind of at the end, is you don't have to do that. From the very first crystal, you can make the choice organically to stop that prayer. To stop that prayer and let the crystal be destroyed. And if you do that, much like back in the day where you could fight Lavos at the very beginning of Chrono Trigger if you did a new game plus, you can kind of trigger the end right from the beginning of the game. You can incite the rage of the bad guys and trigger the end right there by shattering the crystal by refusing to complete the prayer. But this is something you don't discover until later in the game. And once again, we're having an example of interactivity and gameplay being tied directly into the narrative. It's what makes the game so special to me.
Too bad it's not at all fun to play the exact same thing over and over and over and over and over again.
Well, that's kind of a commentary on, I guess, the very traditional nature of Bravely Default. I mean, the whole point of the game was that Square Enix was looking to do something that was kind of classical Final Fantasy style, old school RPG, job system, turn-based combat, randomized encounters, the works. So it makes sense, a lot of sense, that there is a commentary in there about grinding, given that the game is so self-referential in so many other ways. So I found that later part of the game to be quite just very simply a commentary on the old way of doing JRPGs. Perhaps, you know, if you want to read it that way, you can read it as a commentary that JRPGs are better now that they don't have that feature. Or you can, you know, you can read it any number of different ways. I thought that was very much in keeping with the theme of the game. And I think it's a little bit unfortunate that it was so heavily criticized when it was really trying to do something very creative.
Yeah, it's fun, though. That's what it ultimately comes down to. Like, it could be as smart as I want, but if it's not fun, I'm not going to spend time going through the story unless the story is the best thing in the world. And I don't think it is the best thing in the world, unfortunately. Like, it has points that I understand and agree with, but, like, oh, I'm so bored, and I don't like doing the exact same thing over and over again. I mean, if you're going to do that sort of thing, at least, like, disguise it a little bit so that it's not monotony and boring.
Yeah, but the thing about that whole cycle at the end of Bravely Default was it was only monotonous if you chose to make it so. You know, every critic who criticized it, I'm sure they were running through it, right, to get to the end, right, because they had a deadline to get their review written. But every single time that world cycles, new side quests open up that you can pursue that provide you with new insight into the motives of the former bad guys. The story changes in every world because these are essentially new people. So it was up to you to explore ways to make those playthroughs not monotonous. Those boss battles and those dungeons only took perhaps 30 to 45 minutes per playthrough if you turn the combat off. That wasn't that repetitive. It was up to you to explore and find ways to make that not monotonous.
So the game is relying on the player to not make it be boring.
Right, which most games do. Anything's boring if you don't find a way to make it fun for yourself.
And I mean, I guess just to your point, Alan, I can totally appreciate why people might be looking to games simply out of entertainment value. But one of the things that I do love about the potential of narratives in games is, I guess, the idea that they kind of don't have to be fun to be worthwhile. And I look at how, I guess, literature works or how film works. There is an awful lot of films out there and an awful lot of books that I would say are essential to read / watch, where fun kind of doesn't come into the equation at all. There's value in them beyond that. There's any number of ways that a book or a film can be valuable without it being entertaining. And I think one of the issues that I have with how we talk about games in a lot of cases is we do have this perception that if it's not fun, then it must not be worthwhile. And I think that's probably a limited way of looking at games. Not that it's not to be expected. Firstly, because games have the word game, you know, we talk about them as that, and game does imply entertainment. But also because the industry is so new. Back in the 30s and 40s, for the film industry, they were expected to be nothing but entertaining, and people did talk about them that way. It's only as the art form matured and developed that people started to talk about them as more than entertainment. And I think that kind of applies to games as well. We're still at that new stage where people are only just starting to explore ways that games can be valuable beyond being entertaining. And I actually think Bravely Default is a good example of a game that has meaning beyond its entertainment value. And I think that might be where some of the issue comes for some of the fans and some of the critics out there.
I think, you know, for me, it's a game of semantics. Everything's semantics with me. And I always argue that games, video games, absolutely have to be entertaining, that books and films absolutely have to be entertaining. Where I think the problem lies is where we define, as the way we define entertaining. Entertainment doesn't necessarily have to mean fun, and entertainment doesn't have to mean positive. Entertainment just has to mean riveting. It has to engage, and it has to capture us. And where I think we often fail is our assumption that entertainment has to be a positive thing. To cause an emotional reaction is to be entertained, so long as you're riveted by the content.
Yeah, I just want to continue on that stream, actually. My problem is not with games that are that make me uncomfortable, that, you know, aren't, you know, necessarily fun, in quotation marks. My complaint is more with games that bore me. And you can have a game that isn't fun to play, but is still entertaining to play, sort of thing. And I think that's where we need to draw the line, because ultimately, if something bores me, I'm not going to sit through a slog. But if something is entertaining me, even though it's not that good, technically or whatever, in terms of gameplay, I will still sit through that and, like, you know, watch it to the end, because that is a form of entertainment, and I appreciate that sort of thing. Like, I wouldn't say that... what's the game called? There was a game a while ago that made me feel really, really uncomfortable playing it. It wasn't fun. Like, I didn't find it very, very fun at all, but I sat through it because it was really, really entertaining to just see what it would do next. And I think that there's the major difference between what I would consider to be fun versus boring, I guess. I'm trying to explain this, and it's, like, really hard to sort of enunciate why I'm thinking this, but yeah.
Well, the difference between what's boring and entertaining to you isn't really something you have to fully enunciate, because the notion of boredom itself is a very personal and extremely subjective thing. So just because something's boring on a personal level to us doesn't necessarily mean it's bereft of value for other people. And I think that's kind of what's important to point out.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, I guess that makes sense. That we would talk about entertainment as being something beyond or tangential to being fun. I guess where I come from is just I have distinct memories of sitting in film class back in the day, watching Citizen Kane over and over again and wishing I was kind of dead, because it is a terribly boring film. You know, it's a genuine work of art and an incredibly important film that everybody who is interested in film or arts in general really needs to sit through at least a couple of times to fully understand. So, you know, when I always talk about the need that we recognize that games don't have to be fun, I'm always talking about them in relation to my memories of Citizen Kane, which I really struggled to find enjoyable on any level, but at the same time I found it very, I guess, fulfilling and valuable to understand.
And for me, you know, I'm a film guy. I have a degree in film, so like for me, Citizen Kane, as soon as something for me becomes academically valuable, that immediately makes it fun for me. So it's hard for me to separate myself from that, because that in itself creates fun for me. So where I can see Alan being bored by Bravely Default, to me, the act of the analysis that my brain kicked into during that much maligned final quarter of the game made it entertaining to me. It's just all that subjectivity where, you know, where we each find entertainment and value in different things.
Yeah, absolutely. And I guess that's a discussion we will probably continue to have in the games industry for pretty much forever. Well, at least until games are fully bedded down as and recognized as works of art. You know, it is still a definition that we need to kind of continue to discuss. But we'll go to a music break now and then come back and talk about something that's a little bit similar to what we just talked about. Huh. all right, off we go to music. Welcome back. That was another track from Knights of Azure, and yeah, it's really worth looking forward to without breaking embargo. Okay, so let's talk about the last section. we just kind of wanted to, I mean, one of the things that's kind of cropped up over the past couple of years has been this idea of non-games and people use, you know, walking simulator or visual novel as a pejorative a lot of the time to kind of dismiss these games or even suggest that they're not games at all. Obviously, they're all very narrative focused to the point of being entirely about narrative. And it kind of was worthwhile just mentioning those today in the podcast and discussing whether we actually think they are games or not. For my part, I certainly think they are games. They are interactive. It might just be just barely interactive in the case of a visual novel, or you know, you actually have more control than most people give you credit for in the case of walking simulators. But I actually think that they do narrative in a way that books and films can't do narrative, because by being involved, even when it is just to press a button to kind of flip the virtual page, you're interacting with it in a way that you don't do in other media, which I find makes it quite personal and quite meaningful than whenever you take an action. A good example of that is just a recent one, Layers of Fear, which is a walking simulator mixed with the horror genre. Now, there's absolutely nothing in it that is kind of really threatening because it is a walking simulator, but at the same time, I was feeling more tense as I was playing that game than I have pretty much any other horror game, simply because of the way the narrative worked was so intense, and then the fact that I was actually, you know, just opening doors and then opening drawers and finding these little bits of information as I was kind of piecing the narrative together. I felt very involved in the plot, and because I was very involved in the plot, the emotional impact that it had on me was that much stronger. So I just want to open the mic to you guys. I mean, do you believe that visual novels and or walking simulators are kind of games? You know, what defines them as games to you? And I guess more generally, are you interested in them at all?
Well, I'd sort of like to just say, first of all, as far as I'm concerned, walking simulators can be games. I hate the term walking simulator, though. It's dumb. I really, really hate using that. But, you know, I do have my... Like any sort of genre of game, I do have my favorites. Like, I love Stanley Parable. I would defend that game to the death. It's wonderful. It does a lot of things that no other game's ever done, and I really appreciate that. But then there are other examples where there are games that employ a similar sort of thing, but still have traditional gameplay, so to speak. So, you know, Dear Esther, it's like all about piecing together the story about the world. Well, Bloodborne does that. Dark Souls does that. But it has like amazing gameplay as well. And it's like, when there are games that purport to be different, I guess, by not having gameplay, it just seems like it's... It just feels empty and hollow and sort of like a attempt to be sort of pretentious about the game when it should really just be about the artist in themselves exploring a world rather than like we're actually not going to do any gameplay, we're actually going to just tell a story sort of thing. Like, that just seems really pretentious to me, and it's, I don't know, it feels very bizarre, quite frankly, because like, once again, you have games that do have gameplay in a traditional sense and do have this amazing narrative and explore these themes and stuff like that. But it just seems like it's very, very pretentious and very bizarre, and it's being sort of treated as this sort of higher art form when compared to the rest of video games because it's got this focus on narrative. But then when you compare that to other games that also have this amazing narrative but still have a traditional form of gameplay, I just find it to be very bizarre. And I really dislike what the Chinese Room did to Amnesia. Because, like, as much as I don't like Amnesia: The Dark Descent, it was very much, it had its own gameplay, and they took that away with Machine for Pigs. It was just, why would you make something like Amnesia, which is so focused on creating this thing, and then just take away everything about it? And like, I understand there's a narrative there, and hooray, there's a narrative, but you know, whatever. It just seems very bizarre to me. I mean, Stanley Parable, go play that one. That one's great. I like that. It does things that nothing else can ever do, and it wouldn't be able to do it in any other setting. That's amazing. Do that sort of thing.
Just to jump in before Chris has something to say, I guess when you look at these walking simulators, and I say that in inverted commas, because I'm not particularly a big fan of the title either, but you know, when you talk about a game like, to use the Chinese Room as an example, everybody's gone to the Rapture. I mean, yes,
boring.
You could do that game with other gameplay elements like, you know, Bloodborne or whatever. But what I think these game developers do well when they do it well is by focusing in entirely on the narrative, they're able to really kind of tune the audience's attention towards that narrative, which in turn means that they can explore it at a greater level of depth because it is the entirety of the game. And that's why I think, you know, these games get held up as kind of the high art, I guess, for lack of a better word, of the games industry, is because they are so entirely focused on that one thing, and they do it so well that, you know,
that every Ghost of the Rapture does anything well. I hate
everybody
that game.
That's one of the best games ever. I loved it because it was just so focused on the narrative, and it told a narrative that was so in-depth and so emotionally impactful on me anyway that, you know, if there was gameplay elements in there, like if I had to do stupid little puzzles to sort things out, I would have got bored with it. to use an example, I quite enjoyed, what was that Lovecraftian one that came out on the PlayStation 4 about the same time?
I know what you're talking about.
I'm trying to think of it now and I can't think of it. Oh, God. Mental blank. Anyway, there's another one that came out just around the same time on the PlayStation 4, so I played them kind of back-to-back. And while I enjoyed that one, it did have, you know, I had to piece together puzzles, I had to solve these things. And I just got annoyed that I was stuck trying to do those, not that they were particularly difficult, but having to spend any time on those when all I really wanted to do was just to kind of wander around the world and kind of take in the story. I found to be unfocused, and thus I lost a lot of interest when compared to everybody's gone to the Rapture.
You're not talking about Vanishing of Ethan Carter, are you?
That's the one.
I thought it was good. I did enjoy it.
It's not really Lovecraftian, though, I wouldn't say. It's more just like...
it's very Lovecraftian.
Yeah, I guess. Yeah. Yeah. I really like the ending for the game, though. It's a great ending. Just really like the ending. That's all I have to say about that game. I don't want to spoil it. Because if I say anything, it's going to be immediately people being like, why did you spoil it? And I think when that's all the game really sort of has going for it, it's a bit... I mean, Chris, so what would you sort of say about this sort of argument then?
This is something I spend probably way too much time thinking about. As I mentioned in the previous section, I'm a real semantics guy. I spent a lot of time in graduate school specifically studying the art of genre and how do we put labels on things. I love choosing the right words for things, and I'm very, very in love with knowing definitions of things. So for me, when I'm about to say that I don't think visual novels and what we call walking simulators are games. I don't think they're games at all. When I say this, though, I'm not saying it in the same way that the Twitter sphere says it, in that I don't mean it pejorative. I'm not insulting these things when I say they're not games. My reasoning for saying such things are not games kind of just comes from the definition of game. Right, so going to Merriam-Webster, which is kind of the gold standard, the simple definition of a game, the very first definition, is a physical or mental activity or contest that has rules that people do for pleasure. So that statement contains two very important qualifiers, the idea of contest and the idea of rules. So for games, video games in particular, we can extend rules to mechanics and design. The way we play the game, the way we interact with the game, and what the user can and cannot do. And also important that is contest. The idea of contest in a video game manifests itself through struggle and resistance. The idea that there's something, either another player in a two-player game, or AI enemies to overcome or puzzles to solve in a single-player game, something that creates resistance. To me, when something doesn't have those two qualifiers, contest and mechanics, it's not a game. The reason I make this qualification and exclude walking simulators and visual novels from being considered games is that I think what we have on our hands is the development of a whole new form of media. And I believe something more along the lines of interactive fiction or something like that is a better way to refer to these artifacts. I say this because I really believe that if we continue to evaluate things like Everybody's Gone to Rapture or whatever your favorite visual novel might be, we actually do these cultural artifacts a great disservice by using the same tools to evaluate and criticize them that we do use to evaluate and criticize games. We see it all the time, go to a video game website where they've picked the same guy that just reviewed the latest Nathan Drake game, and then they have him do a review for a visual novel. It's very clear that he doesn't have the tools in his tool set to write an intelligent evaluation of that artifact. They're just very different things to me. So when I say they're not games, I don't mean it as a negative thing. I just mean that we need to work at arriving at new tool sets and new ways of evaluating and criticizing them. Because when we do so and use the same tools that we use to criticize Bayonetta, to pick apart something like, you know, Muv-Luv, like, it doesn't work, and we do them both. We do both traditional games and this new form of media an incredible disservice.
Yeah, I mean, that's entirely fair, and I 100% agree with you. Yeah, and then I've got no problems with what you just said. That's pretty much how I feel as well, because it is actually quite hard to evaluate something like a visual novel when you do have this sort of preconception of it being a game. And yeah, I think that we do need to work on a new sort of way that where we can effectively, I guess, critique and evaluate the worth and cultural significance of a visual novel.
Yeah, I mean, I guess I've got some different thoughts about that, but nothing that I kind of want to, because this would make the podcast go for like 6 hours if Chris and I were to start getting really stuck into this discussion.
I do need to eat some time.
Yeah, I think we'll give Chris the benefit of finishing off with that anyway. I think it's a good strong argument anyway. I've got no real issue with the way it's presented. So you know, if people want to think about games that way, I think that's a perfectly non-games like that. I think that's a perfectly perfectly legitimate way of doing it. So I think yay for Chris. And thank you very much as always for listening to the podcast. It'll be up on Podbean, which is probably where you get it from anyway. And then feel free to drop us any comments, questions, thoughts on non-games, games, whatever. And look forward to seeing you all next week. Thanks very much.
Thanks, guys.
Catch ya.
Digitally uploaded.